35. New York City, New York, November 25, 1783, noon. Almost 3 months after the Treaty of Paris is signed, General Washington finally retakes New York. That event will go down in history as Evacuation Day. The sun is shining brightly, although a sharp northwest wind makes Washington pull his cloak tightly about his shoulders. The general is astride his stallion Blueskin, leading a column of 800 American soldiers from Harlem to the Bowery. This army is no longer a band of rebels, but the true fighting force of the United States of America. Each man wears a black and white ribbon affixed to his military cocked hat in commemoration of the alliance with France. Footnote: the black and white ribbon, called a cockade, was worn by both armies. Cockades were generally worn on military hats, but a special design was used to commemorate the alliance with France. End footnote. For Washington, this is to be a day of celebration, soon to be remembered for drinking at France's Tavern, a night of bonfires and fireworks, and the adoring applause from rebel refugees returning home after years in exile, some now bereft to find their former dwellings burned to the ground or plundered of every stick of furniture. The crowds line the streets or look down from balconies and windows, all clamoring for a glimpse of this famous hero, the famous George Washington, whom they have only read about in the newspaper. To the British and their followers, this is a time of shame and misery. After several delays, the army and their loyalist civilian followers are finally fleeing the city. Ships will carry the soldiers home to England in defeat. As for the loyalists, they face uncertainty. The wealthy will be allowed to enter England, but the remainder will be taken by ship to either Nova Scotia or the West Indies to start a new life. Bitter and no longer welcome in the United States, Loyalist families have flooded into New York City with their belongings, desperately hoping to find a place on board the evacuation vessels. Many black Loyalists who fled a life of slavery to fight for the British have also chosen to sail away rather than return to servitude. Some travel to Canada, and others return to their ancestral homeland in Africa. In all, 25,000 soldiers and 35,000 Loyalist civilians are fleeing from New York. Footnote: in Nova Scotia, the town of Shelburne, Canada, also known as Port Roseway, became a haven for white Loyalists. Black Loyalists founded nearby Birchtown. End footnote. Washington's arrival at the Bowery has been timed to coincide with the precise moment the last British ship leaves the dock, leaving no time for looters to destroy what remains of Manhattan. The route of Washington's triumphal entry has been altered to avoid the charred ruins from the Great Fire of 1776, but there is plenty to shock him. The streets are covered in filth and trash. Many businesses are shuttered. Homes are vacant and devoid of furniture, windows, doors, and other fixtures. Fences and church pews have been burned as firewood. Abandoned ships litter the waterfront. Everywhere there is damage from years of overcrowding. But none of that matters now. The most vital port and city in America is finally in patriot hands. As a last defiant taunt, the British have left the Union Jack hanging over Fort George at the southern tip of Manhattan. The ensign is nailed to the top of the flagpole, which has been heavily greased. New Yorkers rush to rip it down and hoist the stars and stripes, but there is not a man strong enough or a ladder tall enough to accomplish this. Muskets are fired at the flag, which defies all attempts at destruction. Finally, a young sailor wearing a pea coat and a canvas hat, who has served since the beginning of the war, surviving time on a British prison ship and in the jails of New York City, runs to a nearby hardware store. There, 26-year-old Jack Van Arsdale buys the equipment that will allow him to improvise the same sort of cleats he might have used for climbing a ship's mainmast. As George Washington looks on, Van Arsdale ascends the pole and rips down the British flag. In its place, as cannon boom a 13-round salute, one for each colony, the flag of the United States of America is raised over New York City. With New York finally in American hands 2 years after Yorktown, there remains just one more obligation for George Washington before he can return home to Mount Vernon and his wife. The General's War is over. It is unlikely that any other senior officer on either side has spent as many days in uniform. It has been a lonely life, with Washington spending nights in more than 200 different homes and taverns over the course of the fighting. Having recently learned that his plantation is failing due to neglect, he is eager to return to Virginia. The General is famous throughout America, lauded as a hero wherever he goes. But His Excellency does not crave power, nor does he long for more acclaim. Instead, he seeks to return to the quiet life of a gentleman farmer. But first, George Washington must fulfill this last duty. On December 4th, Washington says an emotional goodbye to 300 of his officers. He has delayed his departure from New York because the British remained on Staten Island 1 week longer than expected, and he refused to leave until they were gone. However, Washington has promised Martha that he will be home by Christmas, so he must be away. George Washington's going-away party is held at France's Tavern, where he has lodged this past week. "With a heart full of love and gratitude, I now take leave of you, and now most devoutly wish that your later days be as prosperous in your future lives as your former ones have been glorious and honorable. I cannot come to each of you, but shall feel obliged if each of you will come and take me by the hand." One by one, the officers come forward to shake the General's hand. It is a scene of unfiltered emotion, and many of these tough men actually break down and cry. The next morning, Washington begins the long ride home. His fame makes it impossible for him to travel quickly, for news of his journey precedes him. The residents of every town and village along the route cheer him, an outpouring of affection decidedly distant from the horrific apathy of the war years when so many Americans turned their backs on Washington and his men. The journey takes Washington through Philadelphia, where he is lionized and feted at dinners and balls. The public outpouring of warmth is tinged with a second emotion, a national longing that George Washington lead the country. There is now a power vacuum. The Congress was never intended to be the sole legislative authority it has now become. As with Julius Caesar, Frederick the Great, Charlemagne, and so many other military leaders down through history, it seems only natural that General Washington take command of America. But Washington has a better plan. On December 23rd, he stands in a small room in the Maryland State House in Annapolis. The Congress has temporarily relocated to this port city, making it America's de facto capital. Footnote: the move to Annapolis was made for social reasons. The lively waterside Maryland city was known for its entertainments. End footnote. Members of the Congress now sit before Washington. Above and behind the General, a gallery of spectators looks on. To his right, against the wall, sits Thomas Jefferson, newly returned to Congress. Earlier in the day, Washington dictated his last document as Commander-in-Chief. The letter was to Baron von Steuben, thanking him for his zeal and meritorious service. George Washington believes in the unique promise of America and that military rule is at odds with the virtues of democracy. Now, as evidence of that deeply held tenet, the man who once longed for the Congress to grant him a commission to lead the armies of the United States against the sovereign power of Great Britain stands before Congress to resign that commission. "Having finished the work assigned me, I retire from the great theater of action. And bidding an affectionate farewell to this august body under whose orders I have so long acted, I hereby offer my commission and take my leave from all my employments of public life." It is Christmas Day, 1783. George Washington gallops through the gates of his Mount Vernon estate. His Excellency's duty to his nation is complete. Or so he thinks.